This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us for the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. It's been a really difficult conversation, to be honest, that we had with our guest, Avril Carr. She's a death doula, and we often think about doulas being the ones who help bring life into the world there at birth, assisting the family and being as emotional supports as well. But a death doula is there at the end of life, helping with grief, with the supporting the family, and of course some admin as well. Avril Carr is exactly that, and she was on hand to explain what she does, why she does it, and who could ultimately benefit from this kind of support. It was a real honour to speak to her and to take your questions and hear your thoughts around this as well. It was a day of experts. Dinesh Kayalawala joining us. He is a tech editor and was up pretty late keeping an eye on that Apple event. So which of the new Apple gadgets, what from the orchard, are worth our attentions and our hard-earned dirhams? He was sorting out the wheat from the chaff, taking your questions, offering up some reviews and recommendations as well. And as ever, it was pets and vets. Dr. Chris Lloyd from 2 Feet 4 Paws was on hand to answer your questions. We marked Pet Bird Day. What do we need to know? How long do parrots live? You might be surprised. Most importantly, answering all of your questions on everything from what to feed dogs to what happens when they get back from boarding. Do they really try to give us the cold shoulder? Don't forget, you can rate and subscribe to this podcast. Just please be sure to give us 5 stars. Hope you enjoy.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
You can expect a cheery chat about death. It sounds incongruous, I know. Death is tragic. It can be traumatic. It can often be a wrench to ending, something to be feared or ignored until you can't. We use euphemisms all the time, you know, gone to a better place, passed away, moved on. Birth and death are the bookends of life, but we welcome one and dread the other. So why is it that birth is celebrated, but death is taboo? That's what we're addressing this afternoon with a death doula. Now, you might be familiar with the term doula. It's a Greek term. It's been around for centuries. Known for helping people at times of transition, the most commonly associated with birth, offering comfort, encouragement to an expectant mother as she prepares to welcome that new life. But end-of-life doulas have become more prevalent in the past decade. And today we're meeting Avril Carr, who calls herself a death doula, based here in the UAE. Avril, joining us on Microsoft Teams, thank you so much for being with us today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Helen. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm feeling a bit nervous about this conversation, Avril. And to be honest with you, I think that's probably a fair reflection of how many people are feeling listening or even thinking about death, whether it's their own or that of a loved one. I feel like we still live in a death phobic society, and I honestly feel like even though I'm quite uncomfortable, having these conversations are really, really valuable. Can you give us some background on yourself, Avril? You trained in hypnobirthing and sleep consultancy. Tell us a little bit about that and why you've decided to kind of move your focus a little bit as well.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's a great introduction. You hit on so many really valid points, Helen, about death phobia and just the unease and the dis-ease of engaging with conversations around death and dying. It really does speak to how much death anxiety there is around at the moment, and that has been around for a number of generations. So first of all, just to say that, you know, and then having conversations like this, I'm not the Grim Reaper. Talking about your death is not going to bring it any closer to you. We are safe having this conversation, and it is an important one to have. So I suppose I came to being a death doula. This is, I always enjoy getting asked this question. So we have one daughter, my husband and I, Cara, and she was the result of our 6th IVF treatment. So it was lucky number 6 for us.
Congratulations.
And so she's 2.5 now. So we took Cara home when she was 15 weeks old back to Ireland. My parents are totally besotted with her. And one night in the kitchen, my dad said, you know, Avril, when Cara grows up and when she sort of starts exploring the world, you know, going to dances and discos and bars and things like that, he said, try not to worry too much because I will be her guardian angel. And straight away, this like wave of grief came over me, like as I realized that my parents weren't going to be able to see Cara's life in its fullest capacity, like to its fullest extent. And not long after that, like a couple of seconds later, a tsunami of grief came over me when I realized that I too will not see Cara's life. And that's the best case scenario. I won't see Cara's life in its fullest, fullest capacity, you know? And I had such a strong reaction to that. Like, I really had such a strong, like a visceral reaction to it. And I just decided that such a strong reaction merits more sort of investigation. And like you said in your introduction, I'm a hypnobirthing teacher, a breastfeeding supporter, I'm a pediatric sleep consultant, and there are any number of courses that, you know, birthing people can take before their babies are born. And it just seems like there's nothing for death. Mm-hmm. It just seems like death is totally out on its own, even though it's maybe the most intuitive thing we will ever do in our whole lives. And yet it's kind of, we avoid it, we negate conversations around it, we don't want to address it, and yet it is the one universal fact of life. It's part of the contract that we entered into on the day we were born, is that we will all die. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, because it's such a universal experience, I decided then in my investigations, I found a training course with Going With Grace under the stewardship of the fantastic Elua Arthur. And that's how I got sort of involved in death work.
It's a real honour to talk to you today, to be honest, because, you know, I remember when my Nana passed away, we didn't really like the woman that did her funeral. And it's a horrible thing to say, but it really kind of set the tone and almost overshadowed us saying goodbye to her. And I feel like had we had a more positive experience, that would have stayed with us. She would have stayed with us in such a more positive way. And what you're really trying to do, and it sounds like such a contradiction, is giving people a good death, to give people, as they say goodbye to their loved ones, whether that they are the person who is dying or the family who's there to support them and who will need support themselves, that while it's never going to be an ideal situation, there's going to be compassion and dignity there. And we're going to be talking about the empathetic side, the emotional side, but also the paperwork and, you know, the death admin, for want of a better phrase.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
One of the more unusual interviews perhaps this afternoon. Now, mortality terrifies us, but death doulas can help us and our loved ones prepare for the final step. And Avril Carr joining us to explain what her job involves and why she does it. Camille saying, what a brave, kind woman, brava. And as you're saying, I think this is a very good idea and I would use this service. It makes a lot of sense to have support at a time when family members are having to deal with some very challenging circumstances. I think it makes a big difference to have someone around who's aware of all the options and can provide advice, which I think leads to the question, Avril, what exactly do you do as a death doula? You've been talking about dignity and, you know, the importance of being there as a support and creating something of a positive experience around even, you know, sad and often tragic circumstances. But what does that actually look like in practice?
So, yeah, in practice, I offer non-medical support through the process of death and dying for the dying person and for the family surrounding them. I offer assistance. I help to guide through medical and emotional needs. I offer companionship and a neutral friend. I think that's important whenever you are nearing the end of your life, is that you have a neutral friend. You're not... I'm not expecting you to fight this disease that you have. I'm not, you know, a close relative. I'm somebody that's in the unique position to be detached a bit from the family. So it's nice for people who are nearing the end of their life to have a contact person in that regard. I offer emotional support whenever it comes to death anxiety. We can go through together what your options are your final moments arrive. What is a good death? What does that look like for you? That will be as unique and varied as we all are. And just really to be like a lighthouse in the storm, just to support and guide. I offer legacy ideas. If you have like, you know, just a space that you're held in with me to just be yourself, to be in the midst of this, you know, it's a really challenging place to be. If you think about it, we are losing the person who is dying, but they are losing everyone. So it's a really, really delicate, complex and yet very heart-centered place to be.
Can I ask, Avril, you mentioned there about being a neutral friend, and I feel like I mean, anyone who's a regular listener to the show will know that I am very pro talk therapy and always feel like everyone can benefit from it. But I think what you've tapped into there is so, so important, because whether someone is ill or they're dying, the conversations they're having are often with their nearest and dearest. And so often they're going to be worried about upsetting their nearest and dearest by saying things that are going to, you know, perhaps bring them down. And as a result of that, don't make themselves feel better. You know, they're not able to be truly honest with themselves or with anybody else because they think of the impact of their words. And then vice versa. You think about people around someone who is saying goodbye and they don't want to be making things worse by sharing how they're truly feeling about the situation. And what you're able to do there, and as you say, is kind of hold that space and say, you know, you don't need to worry about upsetting me. You can say exactly what's on your mind. That's really powerful, but that's a lot for you to take on. How on earth do you protect yourself and your own mental health and not, you know, spend every day completely depleted?
You know, it's a very interesting thing. Death work brings so much life to me. It's a really hard thing to actually describe. I think it's because it's very intuitive work. I've been on this sort of intuitive journey with myself over the past few years and just learning to, you know, adapt and sink in with my intuition a lot more. So in terms even of mental health, it's really good of you to bring that up, actually, because I'm not immune to the sadness that death brings. Like, I'm not immune. My first death to the client was a 2-week-old baby boy. I mean, I'm not immune to that. I'm a human being at the end of the day. But what I do have is a soft front and a really strong back. Like, I can absorb, I can pick up on what my clients are looking for. I have a really, I mean, it sounds a bit weird, but I have a really kind of unique ability to be able to tap into what people are not really saying. Mm-hmm. And I have a great support system. I have got great support in Going with Grace, the company that I trained with. My husband's great. I take great joy in my daughter, Cara. I cry. I release, you know, a lot of that energy through kind of, I'm learning to play the guitar. I'm learning Italian at the minute. So all of those things take me out of death and back into life again. And you'll be amazed really at how clarifying death work really is and engagement with death is. Imagine if you were to move through your life with one, even half an eye on your death. If you were to use death as your guide or your muse in your life, can you imagine how you would restructure things, how you would just arrive into your life with such a flurry of energy and excitement and enthusiasm for everything, knowing, like, fully having absorbed the fact that one day you will say no more new words and you will think no more new thoughts and you will die one day. So I just think it's really, really life-affirming to be involved in the death world, because it's a constant reminder that this is the road that I'm walking to, as well as everyone else around me. Well, not to be morbid about
it is ironically part of life. And I think, you know, we talked before about living in a death-phobic society, and many people getting in touch this afternoon have with kind of differing views on this. No name on this one, saying, here's my two bits. I believe that once you accept and prepare for death, you lose the spark of living. Everything seems meaningless and it won't matter. I rather prefer the mystery of death. An anonymous message saying, losing our mum to cancer broke our hearts. Despite always knowing that the day would come, on the day of the funeral, we wrote a letter to her. My dad said, prepare a home for us there where you are. It gave us some comfort to know and believe we'll be together again someday and she's no longer suffering.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
We're speaking to Avril Carr. She's a death doula here in the UAE.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And as our attitudes around dying becomes more open, my goodness, COVID has certainly brought death closer to many, many people's thoughts over the last year and a half. Interest in the role of death doula, a companion to support you or indeed your family through the process of dying, is growing. And Avril Carr joining us to explain exactly what her job involves and why she does it. And of course, taking your questions too on 4001. Message here saying, at this time of pandemic when life is uncertain, I try to openly discuss the possible scenario of my death, just so you know, to be prepared for the worst to my family. However, they do not want to talk about it because they say it's not good for our mental health to think about it at this time. What is your take on it? Avril, mental? What would you say to that listener who seems to be quite, well, emotionally healthy in, you know, in discussing this with family? But, and I understand this from family's point of view, you know, sometimes we don't want to go there. We don't want to think about the reality of that.
Well, first of all, I just, as you say, like, I would really commend that listener for trying to have these. It's very, very hard to have difficult conversations, especially when it's with your children, because nobody wants to entertain this idea, but unfortunately we just have to. So it's really great that these conversations are being had. And just a way that I would try and, you know, introduce the topic of possibly not, you know, death on an ongoing basis, but and certainly in terms of, you know, if you think of even children going to school, when they change classrooms, they may change a teacher. Like, to them, that's a loss. You know, the teacher is different now. They don't have their old teacher anymore. And just having conversations in and around more sort of softer areas of loss or softer areas of death, pets dying, things like that. It can really build up your children's resilience when it comes to talking about death and dying.
And a question here from Jennifer saying, what training and background are needed to become a death doula? I know someone that became a death doula after becoming, much like I've done in the past, a wedding celebrant. And I became a wedding celebrant because I went to a wedding and it was terrible. And I thought, well, I can do better than that. And it's so important. And my friend did the same because she went to a funeral of a loved one. And much like I was saying about my nana, just thought, this hasn't been done the way that I want it to be done. So what training and background are required, and equally, what kind of personality or even traits do you think are important, Avril?
I love this question. So I am always a bit shy, a bit reluctant to announce myself as a death doula. I mean, that's the
too
phrase,
late.
That's
we're
the
on national radio.
Yeah, I know, but I am kind of reluctant to do that because I just feel like this work is in our bones. By virtue of the fact that we are human beings, we are all death doulas. We have been helping each other and supporting each other through the death and dying process since time began. And it's just now with the medicalization of death, and indeed, as you said at the start of the conversation, the medicalization of birth, it has been birth and death have been taken out of our homes. But really, we are all death doulas. And so I'm an English teacher by trade. That's what I trained as. And so you just have to have kind of, and I did my training was through Going With Grace. So it's an organization based in America under Elua Arthur. And so that's who I did my training with. I don't have any medical background, as I say, but I do have the personality and I do have the skills and I do have the intuitive spark for this work. I don't consider myself, like, I feel like I'm very at ease in this work. And so that's kind of, I know I'm on the right track when I feel good about doing it. And I think a very good trait to have is to have really good boundaries. I feel like I've worked hard at having, you know, good boundaries in my life, and I have to know when enough is enough, and I have to know when to step back, and I have to. And so I listen to that. Like, I listen to my body as it tells me to rest, or as it tells me to keep going, or as it tells me to, you know, do radio shows. That's kind of
but even having this conversation today, and I know a lot of people listening, and even myself to an extent, find this really uncomfortable to talk about. I really do, you know. I mean, I was tearing up when you were talking earlier about your dad saying those beautiful words about being, you know, your daughter's guardian angel. And we so rarely face up to the reality of having to say goodbye to someone and understanding that, you know, as the song goes, everyone we know someday will die. But by acknowledging it and honouring it, we can do these things in a way that makes us feel better about it, and we can look back with fondness, and that person can die with dignity, or we can mark them with dignity as well. And that's so, so important. So if this is making you uncomfortable, I'm sorry, but I feel like we know it's so important to be asking ourselves these questions and facing up to it in a way.
Yeah, and the thing about it too is that there's so much satisfaction to be got from planning things yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you are at the funeral of a loved one and they have planned everything themselves and all of their wishes were carried out, I just think it sets us up for a good you know, a good grieving process, or an easier grieving process even. You know, if you're thinking about your loved one and they weren't maybe buried in the clothes that they wanted to be buried in, or it wasn't the right music at the ceremony or things like that, those things, they grate on us, you know, mm-hmm. because they mean so much to us and we want them to have, you know, the send off that they want. So that's why planning for the inevitable. I mean, we buy car insurance every year, but we don't necessarily use it. Planning for something that is definitely going to happen is uncomfortable. 100% it's uncomfortable. It really is. It doesn't sit right in our bodies. It doesn't sit well in our living rooms to have conversations like this. But they're just so important, because we don't want big decisions about our health care and about our end-of-life care to be made by, you know, strangers at a hospital. We don't want to, we certainly don't want to pass that responsibility onto our children, because that can cause, you know, untold, it can cause arguments, it can cause falling outs, it can cause all of the things that we don't want for our children, you know?
So, I just think, I'm really smiling at this, Avril, because my mum, for the longest time, has had in the back of her file of facts her funeral plan. To the point where she's like, Helen, you're going to read this. I'm like, am I? I don't think I am. I think I'm going to be heavily medicated through this situation, mum, but okay. And this is the song I want. She wants Don't You Forget About Me. And then she also wants If You Don't Know Me By Now, which I think is just her way of, you know, getting in a final laugh. But I think she finds some comfort in that, in exactly as you're saying. You don't want to be having grieving relatives or strangers being put through that, if this is something you can plan for now. Julie being in touch on 4001 saying, when my Irish father died, my girls were 10, 7 and 3. They all came to the funeral and most of my English friends were horrified. Yet it was so right for my girls to say goodbye to granddad and see how everyone celebrated his wonderful life. I completely agree. I went to my grandfather's funeral when I was about 10 and it was in some ways horrifying, but in some ways so wonderful to see how loved he was and to see that outpouring. And I understand these things need to be age appropriate in terms of when we expose our children and have these kind of conversations, but it was a really important marker in my life. You were talking then about kind of trying to make decisions when you're grieving, Avril, and I'm curious if you can talk this through. And again, we've discussed death admin on the show before and the importance of your partner knowing where bank accounts are, where life insurance is, you know, where the crucial phone numbers or safe codes or whatever that is. Again, a grim conversation to have one evening, but a piece of paper in a bedside table can really allay fears and concerns and ironically make you feel better about things. What does happen if an expat dies here in Dubai? What can you talk us through the process?
Yep. Well, there's obviously a lot of paperwork involved. So the police will fill in with something called a death report. The body will then be taken to a government morgue. When it has arrived at the morgue, the police will issue a death cert declaration, and then that has to be stamped. Then you need to get a no objection cert to be released. You need this no objection cert for things like embalming and for the release of the body to the family. And then only after you get the no objection certificate do the police issue the official death certificate. And then if you're looking to repatriate a body home back to its home country, you need to get the death certificate translated and attested. You need to contact the embassy of the country where the person is from. You also need a specific no objection certificate from that embassy. The embalming of the body, obviously, if the body has been flown home, you know, there's no option. It has to be embalmed. And the embalming is arranged through the Dubai Health Authority. And then the shipping is arranged through Danata, which is an air cargo provider in Dubai, just at the airport there. And then you reserve your cargo space after that. And then obviously you need to provide evidence to the airport that there is an arrangement made with, say, an undertaker at the other side who's going to collect the body. So there's a lot involved. There's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of attestation, there's a lot of, yeah, it's a big paper trail.
And Avril, is that something you're able to help with as well as the emotional side? Are you able to assist on the practical?
Yep, exactly. It's all everything to do with death and dying. That's what I kind of, well, that's where I come into play. So we say that death doulas work with three categories of people. The first people are healthy people, like the planners, the organizers, people who even feel a wee bit stuck in their lives, you know, because it's amazing. Nothing will sharpen your focus on your life more than engagement with your death. And then the second group of people are those who are unfortunately diagnosed with a life-changing illness. Death, as we know, is coming to us all, but it's coming a little bit closer for that group of people. And really to do with those who are recently diagnosed, we would look into things like maybe making some legacy work, maybe a cookbook or a recipe book or a video series or writing letters together, or, you know, even just documenting what was that person's favorite childhood moment, what was their proudest career moment. And then just really bringing the family in and, you know, describing and sort of making the family really aware that taking care of someone in the last months of their lives is not the same as taking care of someone who's going to get better. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more sort of involved in it. If you have children, how do you navigate that? What are the tools? What are the skills? What are the resources? What are the words to say whenever you've been diagnosed with, you know, a life-shortening illness if you have children? I would ask them to talk about like forgiveness or regret, as you say, things that maybe their own family would be shy to ask, but things that are really nice to have documented as well. What was their relationships like, their hobbies, music, food, books, what type of travel? So
that's beautiful. It really is.
And because sitting vigil then is the final group. So those who are actively dying, mm-hmm. Sitting vigil is a real privilege. It's a very delicate and sacred time. And I'm always honored to be invited into those spaces. And for that, I just create atmosphere and hold space and encourage the family on, you know, really ancient traditional tasks. Like, for example, washing the body after the person has died. I'm able to guide families in doing with that. I'm able to look out for the signs of death as death is approaching. And then just to have like music or, you know, poetry readings or what to say to someone who is really towards, you know, in their final minutes. Sometimes it can be a very emotion-filled time. And, you know, oftentimes the person who is dying is just waiting for somebody to say, like, it's okay to go. We love you. We appreciate everything that you've done. It's okay to go. We are all going to be okay. But, you know, it's time now and it's okay to leave.
What a job. Oh, my goodness. I can't even begin to imagine taking on that role and responsibility, but what a privilege it must be as well.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us this afternoon. We are talking about death today, and birth and death, as I said, are the bookends of life, but we dread one and welcome the other. So why is the birth celebrated, whereas death is taboo? One woman who's not shying away from that stigma is Avril Carr, who calls herself a death doula. She's joining us now.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And Avril, unfortunately, we don't have much time, but I've got two questions for you. The first is, when do people tend to get you involved, welcome you into their lives to help them with the emotional side, but also, as I said, the practical? And I know, as I said, you've tragically helped families who have been going through losing babies and children or sudden situations, but often, as you say, they can be more planning involved, of course, if someone's been diagnosed with something. At what point do you have the honour of being welcomed into a family to help with that transition?
Great question. I suppose anytime, really. It's all guided by the person who is who has been diagnosed with the condition. You know, if they feel, I would, you know, provide a list of what my services are, and if it appeals to them, then, you know, I think that the longer that we have together, the better for making legacy projects and for, you know, getting your end of life planning organized, because these questions take time to think about as well. So, for example, do you have a DNR, a do not resuscitate order? Do you have a DNI? Would you like one, a do not intubate order? Would you like to donate your organs? If you would like to, would you like your family to know the names of the organ recipients? Would you like to write a note to your organ recipients? So all of these things take quite a lot of emotional it's an emotional topic. So they take, you know, a lot of time. So I suppose, you know, the sooner the better, just so that we can get to know each other and that we can feel trust with each other and that we can start our work together.
And lastly, I've heard a number of people saying, how do people find you? I think it's a really good question. I mean, obviously you can message the show on 4001 and we can share Avril's details if she's happy for that. But is there a resource that people could track down and find out more, Avril?
Yep, there is. So I have a website. It's avrilcarr.com. Please don't judge me on my website. It's a work in progress at the minute.
You've got bigger things on your mind, Avril. Don't you worry about it.
Yeah, so all my contact information is there on avrilcarr.com.
Avril, thank you so much. I think message from Julie saying another brave subject. Thank you. Never one to shy away from big topics on the show. And Avril, thank you for really opening our minds to a subject that perhaps we've been shying away from. Can't thank you enough for the time you've spent with us this afternoon and of course the time you spent with people in their lives and as they say goodbye. And if you do want Avril's details, it's 4001. I'll send them over on the WhatsApp. So please do reach out. We're here for you this afternoon. Avril Carr here. And if this would be useful to someone in your life, we will have this on the podcast later this evening. So you can find that on DubaiEye1038.com or wherever you got your podcast, just search for Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're taking your questions, talking about the latest headlines, and I want to know, what was your very first gadget or the one you loved the most? And let's see if Dinesh and I can guess how old you are. It could be your favourite gaming console, your most loved game, first mobile phone. Rima saying first phone was a pink Motorola flip phone. Loved that thing. That is so specific. I can even remember what the keypad looked like. It was not. It did not have good feel, that keypad, at all. Atif, can we give some love to having a night out with your CyberShot camera and uploading all the photos to Facebook the next morning? Dinesh, that was the fear. You'd wake up and be like, you've been tagged in 36 photos. Like, what? Why? Well, how many people have seen these before I can start detagging myself? That gives me actual anxiety. Full flashbacks. Dinesh, thank you so much for joining us. Dinesh Kalyaniwala, tech editor with us until 3. Take questions, look behind the headlines as well. So talk to me about your most nostalgic, beloved gadget. Take us back in time, Dinesh.
So the first memory I have of a gadget, I'd have to say the Tamagotchi. It was
old school.
It was, I mean, think about it. It had a screen, it had buttons, mm-hmm. It had gamification. I can't think of anything before that. I mean, I have other memories like CyberShot, Razer, like you just mentioned.
Razer,
I have those memories. The first time I saw Nintendo 64 went nuts, but Tamagotchi. That was distinctive.
Now, I'm 1982, and I remember playing a computer game that had like an actual cassette that you put in the top. It was like a top-loading cassette. And it was
all of them.
Yeah, but no, not like a game that you would drop in, like a music cassette that you would put in. It looked physically like that, I know. It wasn't like a cartridge. I remember that, and it was like a maths game, which in the late 80s, the height of cool. And then we got the Sega Mega Drive. And that, I spent many an hour playing Indiana Jones, Earthworm Jim and Sonic before the Tetris addiction took full hold. So get yours in 4001. Now, Dinesh, I say this with love, but I can see you on Microsoft Teams. You look a little bit tired. Is this to do with Apple?
Yeah, I mean, I was up to like, I don't know, 2:30 or something, doing the work I have to for the Apple event. But it was a good event, and it was a long one. It was on to like 10:30. Lots of stuff that they spoke about. So but I think that's just the sort of benchmark that Apple comes with now, right? Like, for example, for me, while they announced the iPhone 13 series, all four iPhones, they announced a new iPad, which is always going to be my recommendation if people want an iPad for their kids. But they also announced an iPad mini with a redesign. And I have been waiting for this redesign forever. So like, my partner freaked out because I was screaming on my chair. Like, I'm literally like, yes!
I would urge people to check out, if you don't mind, some mixed language. Dan talks to your reaction to some of the Apple announcements. Now, can you take us a little bit behind the scenes before we start going through the gadgets one by one? How does the event work? Are you sent an invite? Can anyone watch these announcements? What's the deal?
Yeah, everyone can watch them. So yeah, at one time, Apple used to sort of go down the path of exclusivity where you got all your information from, let's say, journalists like myself. But today you go everywhere. It's if you have an Apple TV, it's there. It's on your Apple TV Plus. It's on the website. It's on YouTube. It's on your, if you have an iPhone, it'll probably give you a notification that, hey, it's available here to watch. So everyone can watch them. Like I think YouTube alone yesterday at one point had 1.4 million people watching it, if I'm not wrong. But the thing is, the Apple events now, especially after COVID, I'm not even joking. You don't have to watch them if you care or don't care for Apple products. Their production value is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. So that's kind of where the events stand right now.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are here for you if you're thinking about buying an expensive bit of kit before you get your credit card out or indeed your, well, let's be honest, Apple Pay out. We're here to help. And when I say we, I mean he. Dinesh Kalyawana is with us, tech editor, live on the line. Before we get to the text messages, I just want to get some super quick takeaways from the Apple announcements from last night. What has got you most excited, Dinesh?
Hands down, the iPad mini. I've waited for that for way too long. It's, I think, going to be such an ideal device for people just on the run and gun who want power but just want a small device, take some notes, edit some videos, do your emails. Perfect. But apart from that, I think the 13 Pro and 13 Pro Max are very exciting for content creators because that's kind of where the updates are geared. The 13 will be fantastic for the average Joe who just wants a good Apple smartphone. The new iPad, very, very minor update, but like I said, it's always my recommendation for anyone who wants a starter tablet or maybe one for the kids. It's perfect. And then there was the Apple Watch, a little disappointing on my end. I was expecting a redesign of the body, but we do have a larger screen, the same battery life.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I'm wearing my Apple Watch now and I'm honestly about to retire it. I'm over it entirely. It cheats me on my calorie burn. The battery life is rubbish. And I just got a message saying, listening to the radio the second time today, Dubai Eye talking about Apple. Are you promoting Apple? No, I'm not. I'm actively not, because this watch is about to go in the drawer or be given to somebody. So that is really disappointing about the Apple Watch, to be honest, because that's, I think, one of the big failings where other smartwatches are really, really coming through.
Leagues
with,
ahead.
You know, a week of battery power or longer. Easy. And just tracking sleep and all sorts. We've got a question from Sabrina and Steve kind of relating to these new products as well. Sabrina saying, hi Dinesh, I need a MacBook. Any info on when the new one will be released? What do we know about timelines, costs and availability in the UAE on she's talking about MacBook here, but really across the range?
Yep. Fair. So as far as the new MacBooks go, I can only tell you what the rumor mill suggests, which is that if we're going to believe last year, it should be around next month or November, with availability a little after that. That being said, if you want a MacBook just for general use, a little over general use even, I don't think you need to wait. Just go get a MacBook Air with M1. That's what I'm using right now. I love it. It's just perfect.
Okay, good stuff. So in terms of, apart from the Apple Watch, you know, not much difference there.
Yeah.
Anything else that disappointed you?
Oh, that disappointed me. Mm. It would have to be the fact that, listen, an iPhone is a great, great phone. I don't deny that. But I also do think that they're really pushing their luck with a lack of innovation. Now, I agree that not all innovation is good innovation. So, for example, other smartphones having a 100x zoom, whoop-de-doo, I have nothing to do with it. But as far as now, let's say Samsung, the fact that their phones can flip or fold, that's the kind of innovation that I want to see when I have a price tag that's now with the 6,800 dirhams. Oof. I want to see some innovation. I want to see... I'm not saying that they don't innovate. I'm just saying I want to see more. And I think that's where the disappointment is there.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Relating to the phone, Steve asking on 4001, I've got the iPhone 7. Is this the right time to upgrade? I always feel like that's the big question is, should I be moving to a different model of phone? If I love my iPhone, is this upgrade significant enough to warrant, you know, actually spending the money?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anyone who's on an iPhone 7, 8, even a 10 should be upgrading. And I don't mean this because I'm encouraging you to go spend money. I just mean to say that technology has moved forward. Now, for example, from 7, he's going to get a larger screen, better cameras, better battery. There's just nothing that he will not get on the iPhone 13. And please don't waste your money on pros and stuff. Just buy the 13. You will be happy with it. That's kind of what most people need, and from a 7 to a 13, 100% satisfactory upgrade, I guarantee it.
All right, there you go. Dinesh is obviously joining us on a regular basis on the show, but you do often on your Instagram have a kind of an ask me anything, which I took advantage of a few days ago and said, I'm doing Kilimanjaro and I need, well, first of all, I need a solar charger, which I just picked up from Decathlon. Haven't tried it yet. Could be rubbish. Okay. But you recommended a power pack to me because I've got no idea what the charging is going to be like. So for anyone who's looking for a really good, and you said, in your words, this one is an animal. Tell us about the one that you recommended if anyone else is looking for, because I know camping season's coming up, just to have, you know, when you're on the go. What makes a good one?
So first and foremost, power banks are one of these things where you'll think that, oh, you know, I can see one here for like 20 dirhams or 50 dirhams, and that's what I'll get. But the quality of the cell inside is what makes all the difference. Now, a brand that I've supported and genuinely liked, and I swear they don't give me anything for this, is Anker. And Anker's 26,000 milliamp battery pack is something I have used forever. I mean, to the point where I have friends who go on treks, and when they travel, they take the same power bank from me because they're cheap, and they will basically... And the battery pack is just fantastic. It charges 2-3 devices at a time. There are larger ones as well, but I think the 20,000 or the 26,000 milliamp are the ones to go for. They're long-term investments. They will come in useful. And now most bags, it's not like you need to take out your battery pack or anything. Most bags have a power bank slot, which kind of connects a cable outward, where it's very easy to charge. So definitely, definitely invest in one of those.
I'm trying out in the mountains this weekend. Dinesh is with us this afternoon talking tech. Now is the time if you want an honest review, a recommendation, or just want to share what your most nostalgic gadget is, the first bit of kit that you really fell in love with. Let's see how old you are. So let's see if we can guess. Dennis saying, a record player? Quite possibly. Tiffany giving some love for Sonic the Hedgehog on the Mega Drive. Yes, Tiffany, we could have... We need to get some kind of girl gaming going on, as long as we can go back in time.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Dinesh Kalyanuwala is with us, tech editor, here to answer your questions and help you out with some honest reviews as well. Now, the text line's been rather busy, Dinesh, so we're going to go straight to there, if you don't mind. Anthony, picking up on my moan about the Apple Watch, saying, I've had a Swatch watch that I bought in Heathrow Airport the day I left England 18 years ago. Worn it every single day until last weekend. It's just broken down, so maybe time to upgrade to something that's a little bit more than tells the time. No, keep it basic, Anthony. But interestingly, Petra's been in touch with the smartwatch question as well, saying, looking for a smartwatch with a long, in capitals, battery life and GPS tracking for trail running. Heard good things about the Suunto, that's S-U-U-N-T-O. Any insights? What do you know about this brand and how does it stack up to some of the others on the market?
Right. So I've not used a Suunto watch myself, but Suunto seems to be a company that is extremely focused. Like how, so if your Apples and your Samsungs and your Huawei smartwatches were, let's say, the generic level, something like Garmin or a Suunto would be at a very professional level. So as an example, they've got their latest 9 series. Now in the 9 series, they've got the generic 9 series, and then they've got that one that specializes for climbing, which I think is going to be of interest to you.
For me, so, yes. For 1 week, I'm going to be a climber. And then I'm going to go back to maybe wearing a swatch. So what does it look at elevations? Because when I was out the weekend, I was at Schauke, and my watch basically didn't show that I was very high at all, even though I knew I was.
Right. So yeah, it does. It shows, it has a barometer, it has an altimeter, it has, it's basically made for multi-sports. It's got a very accurate GPS. It's got battery life. Now, obviously, if you're using GPS and if you're out for a climb or a hike, GPS is going to massively drain the battery. So I think it lasts about a day plus, just a bit. But without GPS, the Suunto 9, at least, for example, can last for up to 170 hours. Yeah. So that kind of thing. But my point basically being that it's made for someone who knows what to do with that data rather than someone who needs the data just to understand how the day is going.
Got you. Okay, so this sounds like it could be a good option if trail running is what you're doing. Get in touch with any questions. Dinesh is with us until 4 o'clock this afternoon. I love this from Nitin. He's saying, a nice problem to have, but I've been given an Apple Tag as a corporate gift, but I've got no idea what to do with it. Love it. Only in Dubai. Go on. So what is an Apple Tag and what does Nitin do with it?
So the Apple's AirTag was basically made so that you can put it either in your bag, on a keychain, or anywhere, basically, with anything that you lose. Let's say your keys. Put a keychain, put them on your keys, put the AirTag on it, and you can find, not just know if it's lost, but also find them in the house. So if they fall like into a sofa, in the gaps, your iPhone can lead you all the way right till that gap. So that's basically what the AirTag is for. I actually have two of them. I have one that's always in my bag and one that's always on my keys. Even though, touch wood, I don't lose things, but it's nice to know. And it gives you a little notification that, hey, you've kind of moved away from your keys for a while now and things like that. So could be useful. Check it out.
Are they expensive? I have to say, I'm touch all the wood. I'm not someone, you know how some people go out every weekend, I've lost my phone again. I'm like, are you? Like, how is this possible? I'm not someone who loses things. I don't feel like this would perhaps be money well spent for people that generally are pretty, you know, careful with these things.
Careful.
Yeah. Are they expensive?
So the funny thing is, they are not expensive in the sense that they're worth the investment if you're a careless person. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is, Apple's own keychain is almost the same price as the AirTag because it doesn't come with its own little keyhole because Apple is Apple. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you need to buy one of their little pockets to put it into, which is just the most Apple thing ever. And there's even an Hermes version of that, which is just some ridiculous price for a keychain, but they're affordable, 129 dirhams.
Okay, there you go. So if you are prone to, could I put one on a dog? Could I put one on a child? I don't know.
Yeah.
I could. Maybe it is money well spent because they do love running away from me. We're looking behind the headlines now. And interestingly, social media we know gets an incredibly bad rap and in some ways completely justified in terms of impact on mental health, especially as studies have shown in young women, teenagers as well. So what responsibility do these platforms have to protect the mental health of their users? Interestingly, TikTok has just announced a set of features to help users struggling with mental health issues and even thoughts of taking their own life. And it includes a guide to well-being, support for people who are struggling with eating disorders, for example. And if you search for certain terms, they have an intervention feature. And I just wondered, Dinesh, what kind of responsibility do you think platforms like TikTok have when it comes to the well-being and even the mental health of people that are using them on a fairly frequent basis?
Yeah, so I think that not just TikTok, but all of them, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, all of them have a massive responsibility where this is concerned, because something that might be shown and you hear about these horrific incidents that were shown live or something like that, and you're like, how did a company of this size not catch it? which is just absolutely ridiculous. But that being said, I do appreciate, and I will not lie about this, I do get a lot of information on changes constantly, especially from TikTok, that they're constantly making in this regard. And I guess it's a process and it takes time. So it's good on them. But the things like, now today, if you search a hazardous term, they're going to, instead of just showing you what you searched by relevance, they're going to basically show you mental health guides. They're going to they're going to put these additional resources into giving you content that might just deter you from what you're looking for. Because if you're searching for a hazardous term, you clearly are in a bad place, especially if you're searching for it on social media. So I think that it's good on them. I mean, even things like they're working on having much stronger content warnings as well. So instead of just giving, you know, that we get that sensitive content thing on Instagram.
Yes.
Now, this is TikTok we're talking about, but they're going to apparently make it even more visible, even more, I think even more in your face, so that you just kind of stay away from it. Because sometimes, you know, you think that, oh, what's the worst thing, right? Because your curiosity kicks in and you're like, oh, let me click on this. But it's something you just weren't prepared to see.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously Instagram has this ability to flag certain content. And I'm thinking about when I've posted about COVID or vaccines,
right,
or shared something from ARN News with the latest numbers. And they're able to put that kind of flag up,
yep,
which says, you know, content contains COVID-19 information.
Right.
And I'm just curious how far this could go, because I feel like surely there's got to be another use for that kind of technology. And we think about, you know, hate speech, you know, racist content, obviously,
right,
abuse. And we see actually when it comes to dog charities here sharing information, that sensitive content comes up. Surely, and I do firmly believe that these companies do have responsibility. Sometimes it looks a little bit token to be putting out,
yeah,
some features, but they do ultimately have a responsibility. They're making a huge amount of money. And we've said this before, the term users is only really applied to people who are on social media and those who are abusing substances.
Yeah.
But what other implications do you see in the future? Have you heard any whispers about other features coming into play, Dinesh?
So from what I've heard, like you absolutely hit the hammer on the nail in terms of the fact that a lot of these seem very tokenish when they're put forward in front of me. Whether I get a press release or I'm invited to an event or I'm sent a presentation, it's always much shown much more than what it actually is. And like I said, while I will give the benefit of the doubt to the fact that these things aren't easy. Now, for example, you know, so I've for forever now, I've shared the daily COVID numbers every single day.
You have. You've continued, yeah, even after I stopped.
Yeah, so I've kept it going.
Dedicated.
For a long, long time now. But, and it always gives me the little COVID tab. But it also gives you the same tab when it's, suppose you're sharing something that's against COVID or anti-vax or something like that. It'll also give you that same little tab, meaning that they've done it, but it's also generic.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that happens with hate speech is context, right? And that's something that their algorithms and their, even in the human scenarios, the context of it is not always understood. So you can't just say, I hate X person, and they kind of pop that into an algorithm and be like, okay, if you see the word hate, stay away from it or block it or blur it or whatever. It's just not possible. They'll get there. I'm sure they will, because the kind of computing power that these apps have now is beyond comprehensible for the average Joe. But I think that it's a slow process, and they'll keep kind of putting news out. Now, this news, taking this news as an example, it's really nice. TikTok is clearly trying to stay ahead of a problem they have as far as mental health is concerned. But is it enough to repair damage? Of course not.
No.
But is it a step ahead? Yes, it is.
And the fact we're even having conversations like this, you know, I feel like, yes, the platforms have a responsibility in terms of that user experience, but also a huge amount comes down to parents, comes down to schools about the conversation we're having,
yes,
with our kids about how to,
right,
use social media, what is realistic. And I don't know if this has come into play yet, but there's certainly talk about it, Instagram flagging when images have been photoshopped. So when we think about young teen girls in particular,
right,
who seem to be really bearing the brunt of mental health kind of illness around social media, that I mean, I think about what the photos I was seeing growing up. It was always, you know, it was pretty girls on the cover of teenage magazines, and you would of pick course. That up occasionally. Now, a 13-year-old girl picks up her phone and it's bombardment. It really, really is. So if there is some kind of flag around photoshopping, around filters, then all the more.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good afternoon. If you've just tuned in, we're talking the latest tech and thinking of our current guest as your very own shopping guide / IT man. Dinesh is live on the line.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Really interesting to get your thoughts on the responsibility of social media companies. Herman saying several social media platforms seem to take the life of our children away from reality. Do you think there should be regulatory interference to have them responsible? I think so much comes back to really how we navigate it as adults, how you know, the phones that we use in front of our kids and how we talk to our kids about the content we're consuming. So for instance, if I'm scrolling, my kids will be like, what are you doing? And I'll sometimes say, I'm reading the news. I'm not just kind of sitting on my phone, or I'm messaging daddy, or sometimes I'm looking at Instagram. But much like I grew up learning how to cross the road or to put on a seatbelt, this is not going to go away. It comes down to responsible use and, you know, an appropriate age of starting, which is a topic for another day, in terms of those age guidelines. Going to the text line, Dinesh, we've been asking you to get in touch and talk about the gadget that kind of sums up your childhood, the one that takes you back. Damien, love this. Now, this took me back specifically to Mrs. Miller's classroom, saying, there's a Casio watch that could change the channels on the school TV count. That was there was always one kid. Damien, I'm so glad it was you. Peter saying, I've still got my original iPod. It's a super pleasing weight and I love the wheel. Sometimes the classics endure. I never had one. My brother had one. And there was such a kind of specific sound and feel to that wheel.
Oh, it was the best.
How long ago was that? I mean, it just can't even feel that long. Jess saying...
it's been a while now.
It's been a while. It has been a while. Game and Watch and Walkman. What's a Game and Watch? Am I missing something?
Sorry?
I don't know. Jess, let us know. Walkman, yeah, mine was yellow. It was amazing. Let's go to the questions. Trying to hopefully save you some money, or if you are going to spend it, make sure you're spending it on the right thing. Suman wants to know, are expensive electric razors worth it? Now, I can see you on Microsoft Teams and you're a bearded man, Dinesh. Do you use an electric razor and do you think they are worth the cash?
I mean, I've used a bunch. I have like, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them. But I think that they're worth it. If it comes down to the person's beard, if you are someone who goes clean shave, I mean, I'm not a big fan of a razor. It just doesn't feel nice. You have to nourish the skin afterwards. I prefer a regular razor, nice water with your gel foam, takes care of the skin. So I'm not a huge fan, but that being said, there are some nice ones in the market now. There are some dual ones in the market now, so you could look into those.
My husband he veers between bearded man like you and completely clean shaven. And when he goes clean shaven, he just goes to the barber. I think, I don't know how to put this sensitively, depending on where you're shaving, I would say don't cut corners or indeed anything else.
Yep.
Fair to say? For any manscaping going on out there? Apparently Game & Watch, thank you, Charlie, is a Western bar handheld game. I've Googled it. It looks like going back in time. It's phenomenal. You can get them on Noon. It's Nintendo Game and Watch.
Right.
All right, Legend. Okay, right. Fine. I'm in. I am in. I once opened a bank account because I got a free bright blue Game Boy. So I am a total sucker for this. And last question of the day from Piero saying, home projector for use in the desert. Help. We are getting into camping season, and have you come across any ones that actually do you think are worth packing?
Yeah, definitely. There are two of them, actually. One is, so I'm not going to mention the specific model because there are each of the brands has three versions, but there's one by BenQ and there's one by Nebula. Both of them, I think there are two versions. Both are 1,000 and 3,000 dirhams each, so depending on the quality and all that stuff. But you've got them. They come integrated with their own batteries, speakers, the whole thing. Literally just take it out, pop it somewhere. If you've got a place to project, go for it. Both products, used, tested, love both of them.
You're a star. Dinesh, for anyone who wants to check out your reviews and indeed your reactions to the Apple event last night, you can be found on Instagram at Dan Talks. That's Dan with two A's. You're a star.
Yes, ma'am.
The final words to Jerry saying, first Seiko digital watch / calculator, for yes, it was double duty, with an alarm that drove the teachers round the bend as no one has ever heard such a noise. Beep, 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 beep. And yes, Game & Watch brand, handheld electronic games developed, manufactured, released and marketed by Nintendo from 1980 to 1991. And what a golden era for technology it was. Dinesh, always a pleasure. We'll have you back very soon. Thank you to you guys for all of your questions, your messages, and taking me down memory lane.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is all about your animals. So get any questions in on 4001. Joining us live on Microsoft Teams is Dr. Chris Lloyd from 2 Feet 4 Paws. So preen your feathers and warm up your singing voice, because September 17th is Pet Bird Day. Dr. Chris, who knew things such a thing existed? How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. You are a bit of a bird man. You've treated a number in your time. Tell us a little bit about some of the birds you have met and indeed treated.
We've treated quite a varied, from the common pet ones, I suppose. So, you know, all the from budgies and cockatoos and things like that. So some up to sort of ostriches and emus and penguins and vultures and eagles and falcons and all these sorts of things. Yeah, so pretty much most of them, I would say.
And let's turn our attentions to the more pet home friendly variety, unless anyone at home has a penguin, in which case I'd love to see a photo. What are some of the most common varieties of pet birds that are perhaps a good entry-level pet, shall we say? Because I know some really do need some specialist care, attention, and indeed cash to look after them properly.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, you know, the birds that people probably wouldn't want to start off with are things like lovebirds, budgies, maybe canaries, small finches, things like that. They're like miniature versions of the cockatiels and the budgies. They're like miniature versions of the bigger parrots, really. So it gives you a good introduction of what you need to do for nutrition, care, training, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Any misconceptions about how easy birds are to take care of? What do potential owners need to know?
Well, birds can be a massive undertaking. You know, I mean, probably one of the sadder, more common things we sometimes see are impulse buys of some of the larger birds like macaws and cockatoos. And, they really are a massive, massive commitment. You know, like one of the larger cockatoos would probably would pair bond for life with another cockatoo. And it would then in the case of a pet owner relationship, it will imprint on the owner. And so unless you've got that amount of time to dedicate towards the animal, it's going to become a problem situation, you know, with feather plucking and with shouting and screaming and things like that. So they need an awful lot of mental stimulation, an awful lot of time, and people that go into that not having educated themselves properly, you know, usually tends to end up fairly badly, you know, rehoming, things like that.
Can you talk to us about lifespans from the short to the, in some cases, surprisingly long?
Yeah. So, you know, you can get some of the smaller parrots with, you know, the budgies and so on. They can go sort of 15, 20 years.
Wow.
Some of the larger parrots, maybe up to about 60, 70 years, maybe even a bit longer if you're lucky.
Crikey. So this could be, I'm sure you've seen parrots left in wills to people, you know, just passing it through the generations.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well,
not uncommonly, yeah.
Mind boggles. But it has been shown bird ownership cited as an excellent form of companionship. 44% of bird owners in the state saying they're amazing stress relievers and actually good for improving your health. Illustrating what apparently humans have known for thousands of years, that having birds as pets can demonstrably improve your life. So are you a bird owner at home? Please do get in touch. We'd love to see photos, as I said, marking Pet Bird Day, which falls on Friday.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
And our expert of the day is Dr. Chris Lloyd. He is joining us from 2 feet, 4 paws. No name on this message, Dr. Chris, saying, I have 2 cats and want to adopt another from our parking, but after doing some tests, the vet has said that the stray cat is FIV positive. It broke my heart. Is there any way I can keep her with my 2 other cats? Can you explain a little bit around what that means and what the implications could be for adopting?
Well, FIV is a virus, so it's, I suppose it's the feline equivalent of HIV in people, although there's no transmission between humans and people, between cats and people at all, completely separate. But it's called feline immunodeficiency virus, and it's transmitted through intimate contact, I suppose would be the best way of saying it, or also through fighting, blood and saliva transfer. Most cats that have it, the vast majority can live most of their life without becoming affected by it. So I suppose if you look at it as analogous to HIV, you can carry HIV without sharing any particular, and that it affecting you. Of course, when it becomes AIDS, then you're immunosuppressed and affected by the virus. Now, similarly in cats, FIV can be completely asymptomatic. However, in some cats, and it's quite a small percentage, they will start to become immunosuppressed and affected by it. But a great majority can live their full life without becoming affected by the clinical signs of the disease. First thing I would say is if he's been tested and shown to be positive once, I would probably retest him or her again in about a month or two's time to see whether it's just been a transient infection, because sometimes they can throw it off and pass it on and not be positive. But otherwise, there is, you know, potentially a risk of transmission if you bring the cat in, but it would be usually through fighting or mating or, you know, bites and so on, or grooming each other, especially if they had, you know, bleeding lesions in the mouth. But it's unless that's going on, it's not hugely likely to be transmitted. And as I say, the chances of it affecting the lifespan of the animal are no guarantee that it's going to affect it. But there is risk involved, so it really depends on your appetite for that risk, I suppose.
Well, Lorraine's been in touch saying my FIV cat was 19 when he died and was with 7 other cats. So nice to hear a happy story there. And
exactly.
Let's see if we can help Lorraine out. Actually, she's been in touch saying, do all fluffy cats get hairballs all the time? My cat Greg wants to know. Greg is an excellent name, Lorraine. Thank you for sharing your pet's name. Fluffy cats and hairballs, is it a given?
No, not necessarily. It really depends a lot. Depends on the diet, on the age, or any concurrent issues going on with the cat, and also, you know, how well is it groomed and looked after. You know, if you brush your cat on a daily basis, a long-haired cat, and getting rid of dead hair, then it's not going to ingest as much hair. Now, most hair should be passed through in the, you know, through with the feces. So, you know, certain diets will help to entrap that hair, and it will be passed through normally. But, you know, of course, if you have a buildup of hair and the animal becomes sick for whatever reason, dehydrated, the hair could start to consolidate and become more of a problem in the stomach. But yeah, most cats will always, I mean, when they groom, they'll always ingest hair. It really just depends on the quantity, so, and the amount that, and the type of food that it's eating. So, you know, if you're using something like a raw cannon hairball diets, or you can use some laxatives, some paraffin-based sort of food additions that can help to pull the hair together and let it pass through, then yeah, it's usually not too much of a problem. Hairballs tend to be one of those sort of go-to things that people use to explain a whole symptom of different sort of gastrointestinal signs in cats, and it's more often than not due to hairballs.
Okay, there you go. Hope that helps Lorraine and indeed Greg. We've had a number of messages too, in fact, about boarding. Andre's dog has come back with horrible breath and stained teeth. Rich's dog has come back with an upset tummy. We're going to be coming to those very soon. And SJ's been in touch on 4001 saying, is there anything wrong with getting my dog neutered whilst he's already sedated for a leg x-ray? One to avoid sedating him twice, or would vets object to this? Great question, SJ. What would you say to that, Dr. Chris?
Absolutely fine. I mean, I obviously don't know the actual specifics of this case, but generally speaking, if you have an animal that's come in for an X-ray, say for instance, you would have a younger Labrador or a German Shepherd or something, say a breed that was predisposed to something like hip dysplasia or hip abnormalities, then you might well castrate it at the same time as you do X-rays. So there's no issue with that at all. You know, doing the two procedures back to back is absolutely fine.
Good to know. So, yeah, obviously, no hard to know the specifics, but yeah, in theory, why put them through it twice?
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Dr. Chris Lloyd is live on the line to help you out with those, well, furry friends and foes.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
So let me take you back to our Friday afternoon. I am chilling at home. We're moving house. I'm doing a bit of sorting out. You know, those drawers that you basically don't look in for years. I was tackling them with a bin bag. And suddenly our dog started screaming. And I've never heard a sound like it. It was horrendous, like shrieking. Poor guy just started making the most horrendous sound. And I felt his tummy and he was really reluctant to let me touch him. Stomach was absolutely rigid. He's trying to get away from us, screaming. Called the vet straight away. Said, bring him in. It's Friday afternoon, bear in mind. So emergency vet, 2,000 dirhams later. Do you know what he had? Wind. He had wind. 2,000 dirhams to tell us that he needed to, relieve himself extensively in the garden. They are very lucky that these pets love us. But yeah, he wasn't popular, let's just say. 4001, if you want to rant about your animal, or if you just have a question for Dr. Chris. Dr. Chris, I could have swung for him. I really could have. It's like, Jarvis, yeah. get into the garden. If you could just sort it out away from me, downwind, presumably, yeah, would be great.
It does sound annoying, but at the same time, you know, bloat in dogs is can be life threatening. So you do need to be quite careful about that sort of thing.
He came back high as a kite.
Did he? Okay. Well, you know, there's a benefit there, hey?
Yeah, he enjoyed himself. 2,000 dirhams worth of doggy drugs. Right, yeah. Going to the text line, because we have had so many questions coming in on 4001. As I said, get in touch with the show for any questions, comments. If you want to share some symptoms that just aren't adding up for you, we'll put you in the draw to win that goodie bag from Royal Canin. Andre has been in touch saying, "Hi, doctor. My dog came back from boarding with horrible breath and stained teeth. I managed to whiten them with toothbrush and sprays, but the bad breath seems to persist. Please help me. Could this be related to boarding, or do you think it's timing perhaps here?"
I think it's probably timing, potentially incidental. I mean, you know, things like bad breath can get worse if they're a bit dehydrated. So, you know, there can be systemic conditions which could predispose them to having halitosis, you know, bad breath. But the most common thing is that they have some gingivitis. You know, they have plaque buildup on their teeth, some inflammation around the gums, and, you know, it can be surprisingly pungent. So it's probably best to get him checked out, I would think.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Hope that helps, Andre. Message from Lorraine saying, "Thank you about the hairballs. Please thank 2 Feet Four Paws for saving my very, very, very badly injured cat Kalu about 4 years ago. Was hit by a car, lost a leg and half a tail, had so much skin missing and many other injuries. They were amazing and the cat is still going strong." That is lovely to hear. Aww. Emma's loving my story about my windy dog. All contributions. I'm going to set up some kind of GoFundMe page for Farty Jarvi. Herman's been in touch saying, "I've tried to feed my dog with fresh veggies and he started loving it to the point he loves it now more than meat and dog food. Is it healthy for him or should I stop feeding him fresh veg?" What would you say when it comes to, it's not even a treat, you know, cucumber or carrot, that kind of thing, but what are the boundaries when it comes to safety really?
Well, I mean, I don't think you're going to have any issues. You know, obviously you can't keep a dog on a purely cucumber and celery diet, you know, just like you couldn't do it yourself. So, you know, dogs they're omnivores. They will eat vegetarian based foods, but also it's good for them to have meat in their diet. Fruit and vegetables, especially vegetables as treats, is absolutely fine. Not something you want to use as an exclusive diet. You know, obviously. I mean, a lot of people like to. I mean, there's a lot of talk about and personal preference about what sort of diets people like to give their animals. You know, raw diets are very popular. Some people swear by the processed, you know, raw canine and other types of diets. If you're trying to make a home mix of a diet by yourself, it can be quite a complicated thing to do to get it completely balanced. And so, you know, processed raw foods like Fairchild would be great. But if you want to go down the route of making it yourself, I would supplement it with a processed, you know, commercial dog food, mm-hmm. like a raw canine or something similar to that.
Especially, you know, and sometimes it's just not suitable for an animal. You know, like our dog Jarvis has a kidney problem, which, you know, we couldn't even begin to work out the chemistry of how to make his own soup food. So of course we get a medical diet for him. Yes. Just another source of money. Dr. Chris Lloyd is with us this afternoon. So if you've got any questions relating to your pet, or you just want to share a story about how they've been costing you a small fortune, get in touch. You can also give us a call, which is what Mark has done.
I have a pet cat and I love to play with my nephew's pet bird. But I'm worried if we're not around, the cat might harm or eat the bird. Is it possible that the cat may change his attitude once we're not around?
It sounds like a cartoon. They've got a cat who loves to play with a pet bird, but Mark's a bit worried that when they're not looking, the cat's behaviour might change. So eating or harming poor little Tweety.
Well, yeah, I think under supervision would be fine. You know, there's certain, I mean, I used to have it really depends on what type of bird it is. You know, a small little bird like that could, you know, the cat could suddenly decide to do some damage, even if it wasn't intentional, you know, just a swipe with a paw or something like that could easily harm a small bird. But I used to have an African grey myself, and he was quite dominant in the house. He used to walk around, you know, bite
strutting.
The cat on the tail and the cat run away. So it does depend on the animal, I guess.
Okay, but yeah, you don't want a situation, Mark, so perhaps only under supervision. Yes. We heard from Andre before, whose dog seemed to come back from boarding with some smelly breath. Rich has a dog that's been come back from boarding with a week of sickness, and he said it's in brackets, front and back end. Does this sound familiar? Is she punishing us? Is your dog so vindictive that she would have what we call on our house poo soup?
Some sort of protest.
Exactly.
I think before you came to that conclusion, you'd have to rule out some potentially medical causes of it. So there are certain contagious causes of vomiting and diarrhea that they can pick up from, you know, any sort of multi animal environment, such as a kennel. And I would certainly take your dog to the vets, just get him checked over, and take with you a fresh fecal sample as well, a fresh poop sample, as unpleasant as it sounds, but it's very helpful to try and find out if there's anything, contagious or something that we can just easily test for and treat.
And I guess that's, you know, much like when humans travel, sometimes you're in an unfamiliar environment, the food might be different, something could just upset the balance, really.
Yes, absolutely.
Dr. Chris, can you help with fish?
Sure.
Sure. Message here saying, algae in the fish tank. My husband has spent a ridiculous amount of time and money on trying to sort out our fish tank, in brackets, fancy goldfish. I don't think that's their official name, but let's go with that. The fancy goldfish. Within a day or so of cleaning the tank, it's once again filled with algae. What could we be doing wrong? Any ideas? There's been no mention if there's any kind of filter or kind of motor or anything in this tank, but I'm guessing if there's been significant time and money on the fancy goldfish, it probably is a pretty good setup, I would imagine. What can be some of the common reasons behind it?
Okay. Well, it's kind of an aquarist question, I suppose, but I mean, the common cause, the things like algae will come from tanks that are too close to windows. That's one possible cause. The other is that you don't have enough planting in the tank, or your carbon levels are a little bit too low. So you need to, you can get supplements that you can, water supplements that you can add to the tank that help to reduce algal blooms. Obviously the filter system, water changing. There'd be the common things that would put. Then there's lots of different types of algae as well. You know, you can have the green algae, or you can have these sort of black beard algae, which all have slightly different sorts of causes. water changing, supplement, not overfeeding, not too much protein and too much, adding too much food to the tank. That's another common cause of
interesting of about the sunshine as well. Maybe a change of position might help.
Yeah, sure.
Right, let's go to Sanjit, who's been in touch about Shelby. And as I always say on Pets and Vets, we do love to know what your animals are called, so please be sure to include that on your message. Sanjit's wanted a tortoise since he was 12. Finally got one, Shelby. Just wondering, any hints or tips would be greatly appreciated from Dr. Chris's time as a vet. Oh, love this. I'm thrilled for you and Shelby. So for anyone who's listening who's loved the idea of getting a tortoise, what do we need to know as potential pet owners?
Well, it depends what the type of tortoise it is, for starters. So just as an aside, if you wanted to had a picture of it and you wanted to contact our clinic, we can send you care sheets on how to look after specific species. The most common types in Dubai would be African spurthi, which is one of the biggest tortoises going, one of the biggest land tortoises going. They start small, but he'll get up to they can get up to about sort of 60, 70 kilos.
They must live live to a ripe old age as well.
Well, they can, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then the other is the European sort of the Greek tortoise, I suppose, that you'd probably be familiar with from your childhood. It's from North Africa and sort of southern Mediterranean area. They're also common here, so they're called Mediterranean spurthi tortoises. So they have slightly different nutritional requirements, but one thing that they all consistently need is they need good temperatures. Reptiles are animals that rely on external heat to keep their body at the right temperature. So you need to provide that environment for them. They need to have access to temperatures around 30 to 32 degrees Celsius at any time. If they want to get underneath a lamp or something, they need to get access to those temperatures. Their dietary requirements, as I say, are slightly different depending on the species, but all vegetarian mostly for those two species, and lots of fiber. Not too much in the way of fruit or high sugar foods like tomatoes, strawberries, things like that. Natural sunshine is quite important. And if not natural sunshine, then a artificial bulb that produces ultraviolet UVB light, because it's very important for their calcium. And soft shells and soft shell turtles and tortoises are quite common here. Yeah.
Sanjit, please send us a photo of Shelby, especially if he is indeed between 60 and 70 kilos. I'm desperate to know. Right, we're going to go to perhaps a smaller creature. Jared's been in touch about a Syrian hamster. They've had it for 13 weeks, been chewing the cage constantly. Jared says she's chewed at all of the plastic base and now has a hole in it. We've tried rubbing lemon on the part she chews, but seems to like it. What can we get her to do to stop? Or should we get a new cage? And if so, which one? We had a hamster that we loved. She was called Lucy and she was just the most gorgeous little creature. And we put her cage up next to a wall. And when we moved her away, she'd eaten a hole in the curtain that, I'm not exaggerating, was about a metre across. They chew like bilio. Is this just who they are? Is this just the nature of the hamster? Can they be deterred?
Well, it is in their nature to chew. So we want to try and give them other things to chew instead of the cage. So things like, cardboard rolls and insides of toilet rolls and things like that. Make sure they've got plenty of nesting material. They're nocturnal as well. So, she could be chewing as a result of stress. They don't like to be, tucked away in bed during the day and active at night. They're also extremely active at night. They will cover large distances, a couple of kilometers at night, and then so they need exercise. So they need a wheel or something like that would be the easiest solution for that. And just let them go at it all night on the wheel. They'll run for miles.
Crikey. Kilometers.
Yeah. Yes,
their little
for sure.
Legs.
For sure. Yeah, those little legs. Exactly.
Okay, so we need some mental and physical stimulation, Jared. Give that a go, and we're back next Wednesday if that doesn't work. Last question of the day. Janie's been in touch saying, got 15-month-old lab/golden retriever/desert special. Had his neuter operation end of last week, now on day 5 of recovery. Been feeling really sorry for himself with either a cone or bodysuit, both of which he hates. He's had lots of love and cuddles, and I fully expect the old, naughty, energetic dog we know and love to be back soon. Will we notice a behaviour or energy change? Is he likely to be calmer or less energetic because of the procedure? What about long-term effects in a dog such as this?
No, not really. I mean, they're in castrated male dogs, their body composition may change a little bit, and that they have maybe an increased tendency to put on a little bit of fat as opposed to muscle. However, their energy levels should be exactly the same, and will probably be more correctly directed than if they're entire, if you see what I mean.
Entire. Yes.
And intact. Yes, intact, exactly. Should be a much better, a better companion without that distraction, I would say.
Good to know. Dr. Chris, thank you so much. For anyone who messaged we couldn't get to this afternoon and wants to book in a consultation, where can people and pets find you?
Well, we're up in Dubai Land, off the Al Ain Road. We're open 7 days a week till 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. So give us a call, and you'll find us on the web, 2feet4paws.ae.
Dr. Chris, thank you so much as ever for all of your insights. And for everyone listening, we do not brief Dr. Chris on any of these messages. They're coming in real time. He's just that good. Dr. Chris, have a wonderful week ahead. Thank you again.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.